I'm Dan Rundy. I hold the Schreyer Chair at CSIS. It's a real personal privilege to have Assistant Secretary Brimmer with us today at CSIS. Assistant Secretary Brimmer really is a great public servant, and the country is very fortunate to have Assistant Secretary Brimmer in the role that she's in, managing our international organizations portfolio at the State Department. And we're going to be talking today about the preview of U.S. priorities for the 67th session of the U.N. General Assembly. Assistant Secretary Brimmer brings a great wealth of experience. She was a consultant in a past life at McKinsey. She's also been at a research institution such as SAIS, the competitor down the street to some extent, but nonetheless, really a great institution, and brings as a Europeanist, and I think we are going to find the conversation today very interesting. I think with both long-term challenges in front of us, such as the Millennium Development Goals, or some of the security challenges in front of us, such as what's happening in Syria, I think we have a very, very, very full plate. And it's in line. The Obama administration's work through the United Nations is part of the long-standing tradition in the United States of working multilaterally to solve global challenges. And so it's a real privilege to have you, Assistant Secretary. And without further ado, I'm going to hand the floor over to you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the opportunity to come back over here. When I was down the street at CSIS, I used to come over to CSIS and visit as well. And I have the highest respect for this fine institution and appreciate the opportunity to be here. And thank you to all of you for braving the rain to be here. But delighted to have a chance to talk about the upcoming United Nations session and about U.S. foreign policy more broadly. It's been quite a week. And given the outrageous violence against diplomats and diplomatic facilities in the past week, there's been a lot of commentary and public discussion about the role of United States diplomacy and the shape of U.S. foreign policy in the 21st century. And obviously, it's been quite an emotional time at the Department of State as well. But it is precisely at times like these that we need to maintain perspective about the U.S. role in the world and how we approach international threats and challenges. So what I'd like to do today is to offer a bit of a scene setter for the U.S. approach to the upcoming United Nations General Assembly, putting into context the broader foreign policy under the Obama administration. But I think you can't really appreciate quite where we are without looking back. And as we stand here in September 2012, look at where we were from January 2009, when President Obama took office, to where we are today and how that features in the themes we're highlighting in the General Assembly in the coming weeks. As you remember, in the past, the United States faced serious questions about the future of global engagement. We, at that time, were deeply committed to two long and expensive wars, which hurt our ability to achieve our national goals and strained the fabric of global cooperation. Many of our traditional alliances had become strained at best, and our reputation standing was seriously diminished. 3 years ago, the perception of disdain for international institutions that the U.S. was not interested in international institutions risked undermining their capacity. And let's not forget that the president inherited the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression, which generated calls in some quarters for the United States to focus inward, to turn our back on global commitments in favor of addressing the home front. Now, today, a little more than 3.5 years later, I think things look quite different. And as I stand before you today, it's clear that U.S. global leadership is back. Since 2009, we've ended the war in Iraq. U.S. troops in Afghanistan will draw down by 2014. And in turning a page on a decade of war, the United States has expanded our pursuit of a smarter, more comprehensive engagement with the world to better meet the challenges of the 21st century. We've spent the past 3 years reinvigorating our traditional alliances and partnerships. We've forged new avenues for cooperation with emerging powers and other actors. And we've expended real effort to re-engage across the United Nations system, to bolster its capacity for action, and to build connections with other multilateral and regional organizations. And despite the recent trials and tragedies, we remain committed to global leadership based on our values. Last week, on September 12th, the President came to the State Department, and he made it clear that amid grief, we should hold fast to the values that have motivated our colleagues who were killed in Libya. And he said, and we should remember, quote, One thing I'm absolutely confident about is that when we lead with our values, lead with our ideas, and we don't shy away from the world, when we're not consumed by cynicism, but the belief that can make things a little better. But when we embrace that, when we're securing a better future for our kids and our grandkids and for all Americans to come. Now, working in the multilateral world is complicated because the world is complicated. Global power today is more diffuse than it has been for centuries. Non-state actors are more influential than ever. A number of countries are emerging as centers of influence with aspirations to global leadership and bringing their own perspectives to global governance. And for our part, the United States sees this growing diversity of perspectives as an opportunity to strengthen the international order. But these emerging countries must be willing to take on their share of costs and burdens that come with heightened responsibility. With this new international context, our most pressing challenges have become more complex and less responsive to unilateral action. Unlike centuries past, we are not facing a totalitarian threat or an impending conflict between two major powers. Today's challenges, non-proliferation, terrorism, climate change, attacks on human rights, pandemic disease, man-made or natural disasters, pay no heed to national borders. So if ever there was an era for U.S. foreign policy anchored in cooperative responses to shared global challenges, this is it. As Secretary Clinton has said, the U.S. cannot solve alone the world's most pressing problems, nor can the world solve them without America. Yet even as the United States works to strengthen our foreign policy tools for this new era, economic conditions pose another challenge. Quick action averted the worst economic crisis, and our economy is heading in the right direction. But the recovery has not been as strong as anyone would like. That means tighter budgets. But the Obama administration has been clear from the start that the just over 1% of the federal budget that the international affairs account compromises is a small slice, even in this time of increased global responsibilities. And it's one of the best investments the United States can make, yielding huge dividends for our collective security and prosperity. The notion of investment underscores the approach the Obama administration has taken to U.S. engagement at the United Nations. Our belief from day one has been that a strong and effective UN is a key part of the foundation needed to confront the challenges all nations share. In less than 4 short years, we've begun to reverse years of neglect, indifference, and zero-sum international politics at the UN. We've done this by engaging in the painstaking, time-consuming diplomacy needed to translate the global responsibilities embodied in the UN Charter into effective international action. If you look at U.S. accomplishments at the UN over the past 3.5 years, and our focus at the upcoming UN General Assembly session, it's clear that there's a solid return on the investment. First and foremost, U.S. engagement at the United Nations has made the United States and the world as a whole safer and more secure. A top priority for this administration has been combating the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, and the UN has been key in this regard. Over the past 3 years, we've worked with allies and partners to impose the toughest UN Security Council sanctions to date on Iran and North Korea's nuclear program. President Obama has stated unequivocally that we will not allow Iran to obtain a nuclear weapon. And our work at the UN Security Council is just one part of this policy. In addition, U.S. global leadership at the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, has helped marshal a global response to Iran's nuclear program. Indeed, in the just-released IAEA report on Iran, it provides credible and impartial assessment of Iran's continued violations, and it is a perfect example of the value of U.S. investment in the multilateral system. Based on that report, last week, the IAEA Board of Governors demanded that Iran cooperate fully with the IAEA and address the international community's serious concerns. And it's interesting that everyone on the board agreed, except for Cuba, but it highlights how tough, persistent U.S. diplomacy and our work through the U.N. system has strengthened international resolve against Iran's nuclear program. And beyond these tough measures on Iran, we've also worked through the U.N. to advance President Obama's deep personal commitment to a world without nuclear weapons. The United States provides extensive support for UN capacity-building efforts to prevent nuclear proliferation. And as Energy Secretary Chu noted at the IAEA yesterday, the work done by the United States and our partners has helped reduce the global vulnerability to nuclear materials and has made the world a safer place. And next week, UN Secretary General Ban will host a high-level meeting on countering nuclear terrorism, where these and other contributions to nuclear security will be discussed. Also in New York next week, there will be high-level events on a number of peace and security challenges around the world, including the Sahel, Somalia, Sudan, and South Sudan, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and the Middle East. Yet these are far from the only situations that since 2009 where the U.S. has been working through the UN to catalyze effective international action to protect civilians and to work to prevent armed conflict. In Libya, quick action by the UN Security Council saved countless people from slaughter. Since then, the United States and the United Nations have been at the vanguard of assistance to the Libyan people. The tragic attack last week on the U.S. diplomatic compound in Benghazi underscored the risks that American diplomats face there and elsewhere. But it also drove home how important it is that the international community continue to help the Libyan people and help them cement a peaceful and prosperous future. As Secretary Clinton has said, Libyans did not trade the tyranny of a dictator for the tyranny of a mob. So the tragedy in Benghazi only fortifies our resolve to support Libya in its transition toward a greater stability, democracy, and the rule of law. Elsewhere around the globe, U.S. multilateral leadership similarly has helped assemble broad coalitions to address crises and to avert or stem violent conflict. Although attacks on civilians and serious humanitarian situations persist, we have prevented the return to open war between Sudan and South Sudan and ushered in Juba's arrival as the world's newest state. As you know, in 2010, the U.S. worked with the UN to facilitate rapid response to the devastating earthquake in Haiti, which was also showed another aspect of our work in multilateral affairs. And U.S. leadership at the UN and partnership with allies and other countries has also been central to international efforts to stabilize Somalia, reduce the country's destabilizing exports of terrorism, piracy, extreme poverty, and migration. And these and other countries, the Obama administration has worked to strengthen UN peacekeeping missions as they confront increasingly complex and difficult mandates, and they have to deal with the protection of civilians and promotion of stability. As you know, UN peacekeepers, there are about 120,000 of them, are deployed now, serve in many of the most difficult countries, including the Democratic Republic of Congo, Cote d'Ivoire, Darfur, Lebanon, and places where challenges are too thorny or too deep for any one state to fix single-handedly. Over the past 3 years, the United States has worked to ensure that these missions have the mandates so they can achieve their work and that they have the resources and the political backing they need to achieve their missions. And we're supporting the end of peacekeeping missions that have achieved their goals, as will occur in Timor-Leste this year. We're similarly working to support an increasing dispatch of non-military UN political missions to post-conflict settings across the world, including Libya, Afghanistan, and Iraq. And the United States has been a strong supporter of these missions and the critical state-building expertise they bring. Of each of the countries I mentioned, the U.S. multilateral leadership has been key to the global response. And although many of these challenges persist, it is almost impossible now to imagine how much more insecure the world would have been without action through the UN system. But that doesn't mean that multilateral engagement is a panacea or that we will always be able to immediately achieve the political will that will halt a crisis. On Syria, the United States, individually and as part of a broad coalition, has spent more than a year working to halt the attacks by the regime on its people. And we remain deeply frustrated by Russia and China's continued support for Assad. We've said on a number of occasions that the Assad regime and its backers are on the wrong side of history. And an overwhelming majority of the international community agrees, as shown by the UN General Assembly vote last month. And we continue to believe that the political transition in Syria, led by the Syrian people and supported by the international community, is the best path for Syria's future. And the United States is not allowing the Russian-Chinese obstruction of the Security Council to halt the larger effort. Instead, we're continuing to work with partners across the globe to increase pressure on the regime. We've imposed stringent sanctions on the Assad regime, and we will continue to provide humanitarian assistance for the Syrian people, and we have given more than $100 million to date. We will continue to support the opposition, including with non-lethal assistance and direct financial assistance. And we're continuing our strong support of the United Nations Commission of Inquiry to enhance accountability for serious ongoing human rights violations. The Commission of Inquiry is another good example of the value of U.S. investment in multilateral institutions. The commission was launched by the Human Rights Council in 2011, and despite being denied access to Syria, it has compiled perhaps the most comprehensive assessment of the myriad human rights violations committed since the violence began. It is a good example how UN bodies, just like the IAEA in Iran, can provide credible, impartial eyes and ears to monitor and call attention to pressing international crises. Because of the unrelenting work of these commissioners, the Syrian people and the international community will have a strong basis for identifying and holding accountable those who are committing these outrageous violations in Syria. The Syria Commission of Inquiry is a good segue towards a discussion of the value of our work at the UN Human Rights Council, which complements our work at the General Assembly. As you know, when the President Obama took office in 2009, few parts of the UN system needed as much change as the Human Rights Council. For 3 years following the creation of the HRC in 2006, the U.S. sat on the sidelines. In our absence, the HRC seemed to spend more time criticizing Israel than it did all other countries combined. But in 2009, the administration ran for and won a seat on the Human Rights Council so that we could work to improve it from within. And in the short time since then, the U.S. leadership at the Human Rights Council and our close collaboration with partners from all corners of the globe has helped transform that body into one that now regularly responds to pressing human rights situations with timely, concrete action. In just this short period, U.S. leadership at the Human Rights Council has led to a series of important advances for the protection of human rights worldwide, one of our goals that we'll be focusing on again this fall. With U.S. leadership, the HRC has gained and turned a global spotlight on persistent violators of universal human rights worldwide. As I mentioned earlier, the important work of the Syria Commission of Inquiry is an example. But the Council has launched similar commissions to investigate violations in Libya and Cote d'Ivoire and established the first ever UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights Abuses in Iran and appointed a Special Rapporteur for Belarus for the first time since 2006. In passing its first ever resolution in the UN system establishing that LGBT rights are, in fact, human rights, a broad, cross-regional group of countries took a historic leap toward ensuring that the rights enshrined in the Universal Declaration are protected for all men and women, regardless of their sexual orientation. And just since 2009, the Human Rights Council has expanded international mechanisms to monitor and protect core human rights, including freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, and the rights of women to live without discrimination. None of this has been easy, and our work is not finished, which is why the United States is running hard for a second term on the Human Rights Council this autumn. We succeeded in greatly reducing the HRC's unfair bias against Israel, although more remains to be done. The Council has taken up a number of pressing human rights situations, but could still do more. But without U.S. leadership, there's no telling whether the Human Rights Council would continue to be as effective as it has been since we joined in 2009. And for the United States, the protection of universal rights is simply too important for us to cede leadership at the Human Rights Council. The United States is pursuing a similar approach in terms of deep and broad multilateral engagement on development issues. Another point we'll be advancing this fall at the General Assembly. For 12 years, the international community has been working through the Millennium Development Goals framework to dramatically reduce poverty worldwide. We've made real, measurable progress in advance of the 2015 deadline. Extreme poverty has been reduced by half, as has the proportion of people lacking dependable access to clean drinking water. And there has been real improvements in living conditions for more than 200 million people worldwide who live in slums. These are huge advances in human well-being the world over, and they wouldn't be possible without the kind of international engagement and cooperation I've been discussing today. U.S. initiatives on global health and food security partner extensively with the U.N. system, but much still remains to be done. At the General Assembly next week, U.N. Secretary General Ban will inaugurate the high-level panel on the post-2015 Global Development Agenda. The United States is pleased to have John Podesta as a member of this esteemed group, and we support his mandate to carry forward the global fight against poverty beyond 2015. Over the long term, sustaining these efforts to mobilize an effective international response on peace and security, human rights, and development requires serious attention to the fabric of global cooperation. We agree with emerging powers who state that the international order must be renovated to better reflect the contemporary landscape. But as I mentioned earlier, these challenges will require an expansion of responsibility alongside any increases in membership. Aside from member state bodies, when it comes to operations on the ground, in too many ways, the UN system remains stuck in the last century. In this vein, the United States has gone to great lengths to build a more sustainable, just, and effective international order, including working to improve the UN's effectiveness and operations where it counts. We've worked closely with UN leadership and a number of other countries to increase transparency, oversight, and accountability for results across the UN system. As a result, we're seeing real, tangible improvements. We've helped establish strong UN institutions focused on oversight and accountability, made real gains on transparency, including recent decisions by several UN funds and programs to publish their audits online. And now, we're in the process of joining other major donors to become members of MOPAN, the Multilateral Organization Performance Assessment Network, to enhance our ability to assess and promote the effectiveness of international organizations. And we've done so by making clear that our UN reform efforts are focused not on tearing the UN down, but in building it up. We're working to help strengthen the UN's contributions to U.S. national security, to global security writ large, to the advancement of universal rights and values, and to fighting global poverty. At the same time, we've been careful stewards of taxpayer dollars. And last December, we worked with partners to achieve a 5% reduction in the UN regular budget, the first time since the 1990s, and only the second time in history that this has happened. And the implementation of the UN's Global Field Support Strategy, which the U.S. strongly supported and which helps our work on peacekeeping, has saved tens of millions of dollars. We estimate probably $70 million already. Unfortunately, in some cases, we've been unable to fully engage to protect U.S. interests across the U.N. system. As you know, Palestinian membership at UNESCO has triggered a 1990s law that prohibits U.S. contributions to that agency. And as you know, we oppose unilateral efforts to address Palestinian status outside the process of direct talks between the parties. Such moves are counterproductive and set back the prospects for or resuming negotiations. But this old legislation has actually had a perverse effect. So right now, we cannot provide support for invaluable UNESCO programs, like Teaching Respect for All, an initiative that is developing global educational curriculum promoting respect, human rights, and tolerance, the need for which is abundantly clear by last week's events. Nor can we fund SESAME, a UNESCO-based research center that fosters scientific cooperation across the Middle East, including Israel and the Palestinians. Nor can we fund UNESCO's global efforts on Holocaust education. I'll be clear, U.S. support for Israel is unwavering, and we oppose any and all attacks on its legitimacy in U.N. bodies or elsewhere. But the legal prohibition on U.S. funding means Palestinian membership actually degrades U.S. influence, and that damages the very U.N. bodies they seek to join. To conclude today, let me point out that all of us have the privilege of living doing a remarkable chapter of the human story. We are witnessing and addressing firsthand events that will form much of the history of this already tumultuous century. For our part, the Obama administration has sought to address the tumult by forging the conditions for effective international action, and by reinforcing the global and regional architecture to better stand the tests we know it will face. As I've mentioned throughout our remarks today, all of these issues and dynamics will be on display in New York next week. But those high-level meetings will mark just one point along the longer history of U.S. leadership at the United Nations, leadership that will continue long after the motorcades recede from First Avenue. So with that, let me end my remarks. I thank you again for the opportunity to speak here this afternoon, and I look forward to our discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Assistant Secretary Brimmer. I've got a couple questions that I'm going to ask the Assistant Secretary, and it, all of you have on your chairs a white index card. If you have questions, my colleagues will be collecting them in a few minutes, and then I'll go through them. We need to end this a little bit early because of some of the scheduling issues at around 2:50, so we'll end it then, but you'll have a chance to say hello to the Assistant Secretary if you choose to do so then, but then we'll have to end it a little bit earlier than scheduled just to honor her pressing agenda. I'm going to come over here to ask the questions, and then we'll open it up. Well, I've got three questions for you, Assistant Secretary. One is around crisis, and then sort of two longer term questions. And in your remarks, you talked about what's happening in Syria. Obviously, those folks who follow the United Nations understand that much of our engagement on the issue and the crisis in Syria has been through the United Nations. And you referred to the Commission on Inquiry. Could you talk a little bit more about what you see going forward, the role for the United Nations, both from a political standpoint, perhaps also from a humanitarian standpoint?
Thank you very much. Indeed, the challenges of facing the Syrian people is one of the most difficult issues on the international agenda as well. I think we've all been horrified by the significant loss of life over the past year. Just truly, truly horrific. The United States continues to support a political transition in Syria. As I mentioned, that we support the opposition and its efforts to advance the will of the Syrian people. We provide, as I said, non-lethal assistance to the non-violent opposition. We've been particularly active in supporting humanitarian efforts as well. As I noted, we have provided over $100 million in assistance and continue to work very closely with the generous countries in the neighboring states that have taken in thousands and thousands and thousands of refugees. Our colleagues who work particularly on the refugee issues have been very much in touch both with the neighbors in Turkey and elsewhere that are taking in refugees. Obviously, many of the UN agencies are also deeply involved, and we support them as well. And we support the key efforts for accountability. I mentioned the role of the Commission of Inquiry created on Syria, which is providing absolutely crucial documentation. As you know, it was one of the first and probably the most important of the mechanisms created through the UN system, as well as the special sessions. As you know, there were numerous special sessions of the Human Rights Council, again, calling attention to what was going on in Syria. And there's an important effort on accountability. So in addition, there's a mechanism that's looking at how to gather the evidence for accountability, because everybody, whether an officer or a Truth and Security who's committing atrocities, should know they will be held accountable. And the international community will work with the Syrian people when that day comes.
Wanted to just talk a little bit further. In your remarks, you talked about the situation with the Palestinians and their participation in the UN system. Are there milestones coming up over the next 12 months that you see where this is going to be front and center?
Thank you for the question. There's a certain irony here. As you know, the United States strongly supports direct negotiations by the Israelis and the Palestinians. We're strong supporters, strong financial supporters of both the Palestinian Authority and the Israelis. And we recognize the need for direct negotiations as the way to ultimately deal with the Middle East peace issues. And therefore, we think the efforts to go through the United Nations prematurely is actually counterproductive to the larger effort to solve peace. And so we think that it is important that we try to take this issue back to where it belongs. But it's having a damage effect within the UN system. What we're seeing not only is issues in New York, but also across the UN system, where not only in UN agencies, but even at conferences, there's a mini refighting of the issue on Palestinian status before so many conferences. That is getting counterproductive to everybody. We want to focus on the real effort to actually achieve peace, to allow Israelis and Palestinians to talk to each other, to get back to the long-term effort that will really make a difference on the ground and move towards a two-state solution based on security and peace.
Just a housekeeping issue. Other folks may have questions. My colleagues here are collecting cards. And Assistant Secretary Brimmer, the other question I had for you, and it's also coming up in some of the cards already, is taking a little bit of a longer-term view. I think there's a historic opportunity for the United States around the Millennium Development Goals. As you obviously have an important role to play in that in your perch at the State Department. How are you in terms of what are there certain priorities that the United States brings to the table? Are there things that you'd like to see that adjusted in the, if you will, an MDGs 2.0, if you will, are there things in there that you'd like to see added? Some of the questions talk about the good governance, or is there something perhaps on the issue of governance that could be added? I'll stop there.
Thank you very much for the question. I think it's important we talk about all aspects of the UN's work, peace and security, human rights, and development. Indeed, as you mentioned, that we are at an important stage working on the Millennium Development Goals. One of the most important things the president did early on in 2009 was to say that the Millennium Development Goals are America's goals, and recommitting the United States to working with the international community on the Millennium Development Goals. And one of the things the MDGs have done has provided a single process for donors and recipient countries to work, set priorities, and work through key elements that would lead to human well-being. And there have been important changes. I mentioned some of the improvements already. But there's still a lot of work to be done. So I always start off by saying we remember that first we have to work on completion of the MDGs to 2015, even as we're looking ahead. So the first thing is we're committed to the current MDGs. But we're also very actively involved in the process to look ahead. And as I mentioned, that the Secretary General, of course, has taken a particular interest in sustainable development. He's talked about this in terms of priorities for his second term as Secretary General. And there will be several processes that are ongoing, one of which is the high-level panel, which brings together their distinguished people from around the world looking at this issue under the triple chairmanship of Liberia, Indonesia, and the United Kingdom. And different members serve in their personal capacities. I mentioned John Podesta will be on for the United States. We think that will be a very important mechanism. They'll be able to provide some large guidance based on the wisdom of the people in the group in terms of the directions of the MDGs. We also note that there are important processes already underway. For example, of course, there was the Rio Plus 20 conference this year, which laid out some important ideas. And coming out of that process also, there is a working group up in New York that's being formed that will look at these issues as well. And there will be important conversation about the sustainable development goals and what the international community wants those to be. The United States wants to be active in all of those. We think it will continue to be important to understand both efforts to reduce poverty and look at issues that impact people and human well-being while recognizing the need to deal with how issues affect the planet as well. So we think that bringing in both people and the environment with which they live will be important ways to approach these issues. Thank you.
So we have, Assistant Secretary Brimmer, questions about development around, will the U.S. announce any new initiatives, or is there something there that, and it, certainly this is very busy time, but perhaps there may be. Why don't I give you a couple for you to think about? And so one is a question, can you talk a little bit more? You gave a very full answer, though, on MDGs, but are there any, should we be looking for a feed the future or type surprise, if you will, from the administration? But another question is, that's a development question. The other question is, we got a question about Mali. Will the U.S. participate in the high-level meeting in Mali, and if so, in what capacity? I got several questions about that from the audience. And then why don't we talk about the question about U.N. Security Council reform. If you could talk about those three, then there are a couple more why don't we just give you that as a – we'll do this World Bank style. Having been at the World Bank, I know you kind of bunch the questions together to give the person a chance to think about how they want to respond.
Indeed, thank you for those questions. They just, I say, quite a lot, and I'll try to address each of those. First off, to look at the initiatives that are related to development and also human well-being coming out next week. The first is to say that we remember that there's continuity as well, that we don't just announce something and then not follow up. So some of the important work that you'll see at the General Assembly will be the ongoing work on food security and on nutrition. Now, many of you will know that in previous years there have been events that looked at scaling up nutrition and that looked at the food security events, that looked at the 1,000 days proposal that looks particularly at the intensive support for women during pregnancy in the first 2 years of a child's life. All that will be continuing to look at that, and there will be events related to food security that link to the ongoing initiatives, and the General Assembly provides an opportunity to develop the next stage of that element. So that will be an important sense of continuity as well. We will also be looking at, in a different area, I will be looking at the Equal Futures Partnership that the U.S. will talk about, which will look at additional efforts to support well-being of women and girls. And that will link together many themes that you've seen us talk about over the past 3.5 years, and that will be early next week. And so that's the sense of the human well-being and development agenda will be very much a part of the conversation, as will the peace and security issues as well. And several people have asked about the situation in Mali, which links to the whole question of the Sahel. And as I mentioned, the Sahel will be one of the important focus for conversation next week. And we'll see, indeed, the United States will be part of that conversation because it is so important to look at the interconnection of the issues facing Mali and the region in particular. As you know, there's a humanitarian crisis that's one element. We have the security issues. We have governance issues as well. And it's important to know to look at the questions of what will be the right configuration of international support. We recognize the leadership that African countries are showing themselves, and particularly through ECOWAS, through the African Union. And the question was how to work with the mechanisms that would be appropriate to support Mali and its people. So I think it would be an important discussion. It's one of the things you can do at the General Assembly is bring together many leaders who are very interested in this topic together to put their heads together on this topic. So that will be an important focus next week as well. Then turning to the question again, we're talking about, the structure of the United Nations system, and we think particularly of the United Nations Security Council. And indeed, as you know, the United States thinks that the Security Council is actually a vital element of international peace and security and needs to remain to be an effective body. But we also support a modest expansion of the Security Council, as the President has said. We think that it is possible to look in a constructive way about how you might expand the Security Council, but we stress that countries take on the obligations of serving on the Security Council, whether as an elected member or as a permanent member, in their national capacities. So the United States has always said that that if we were to support any mechanism, it would be for individual countries, not for regional seats. But we also recognize that any move in this direction would need to have the support of the membership. And so we recognize we've only changed the structure of the Security Council once over all these decades. It's a serious matter. Whatever configuration that you're thinking about, it has to be durable. It's not something that you do for 10 years. This is something you have to make that will see through the Security Council for decades to come.
Okay, two more questions. Could you speak about Afghanistan and the role of the United Nations system in both in terms of the upcoming transition in 2014? Another question about it's a domestic question here for the U.S. Support for the United Nations requires both Republican and Democratic support. Many of the successes that you cite, including the Sudan and Somalia, have roots in the Bush administration through including PEPFAR and many of the other important achievements of the Bush administration. Could you talk a little bit about how you're working with Capitol Hill and with Republicans more broadly?
From so many people who serve from so many parts of the world to try to help support the Afghan people in their efforts to have a more just and democratic society. And that has come in many forms, both valiant military and other officers, as well as civilians. And I'm going to take a moment particularly on civilians, the important role that the diplomatic community has played in terms of people who work on rule of law issues, human rights issues, economic development issues. And to note, in addition to the strong role played by the United States and many other countries, that also there's an important role for the United Nations. And I alluded to the special political missions. In addition to the very well-known peacekeeping missions, the United Nations also conducts special political missions, which are composed of civilians working on issues like rule of law, administration, and so forth. And there's a very important special political mission in Afghanistan called UNAMA, which will continue after 2014 and will be an important focal point for continued international support to the Afghan people and their continued transition. And then just to take a moment, I talk about support for the United Nations. Indeed, it is extremely important to note that the bipartisan element of multilateral engagement is extremely important. And I'm delighted to say, indeed, that there's been important efforts both by Democrats and Republicans working together to work on issues like PEPFAR, to work on improving peacekeeping, because we recognize this is in the United States' national interest, and it's best we work together to figure out how to improve that well. And I was to say I was honored to have the opportunity to testify in Capitol Hill last week, along with my colleague, Assistant Secretary Carson, Assistant Secretary for Africa. We testified to the Africa Subcommittee in the House precisely on peacekeeping in Africa, because this isn't, you know, Democrats, Republicans, and Americans trying to figure out how can we best make a contribution to the United Nations and advance international peace and security.
Assistant Secretary Bremer, this is just really phenomenal. I know there are many people here in the audience that we're going to want a chance to say hello to you, but I know also want to balance the pressures on your schedule. So I think we're going to end it here. I'm going to ask folks to join me in thanking you, and then I think you have a few minutes to say hello to folks.